prove to you that these words are by no means untrue, nor so surprising as one at first sight would think. Meantime, the journey showed me this, how much we possess that is superfluous, and how easily we can make up our minds to do away with things whose loss, whenever it is necessary to part with them, we do not feel. My friend Maximus and I have been spending a most happy period of 2 days, taking with us very few slaves, one carriage load, and no paraphernalia, except what we wore on our persons. The mattress lies on the ground, and I upon the mattress. There are 2 rugs, one to spread beneath us, and one to cover us. Nothing could have been subtracted from our luncheon. It took not more than an hour to prepare, and we were nowhere without dried figs, never without writing tablets. If I have bread, I use figs as a relish. If not, I regard figs as a substitute for bread. Hence they bring me a New Year feast every day, and I make the New Year happy and prosperous by good thoughts and greatness of soul. For the soul is never greater than when it has laid aside all extraneous things and has secured peace for itself by fearing nothing, and riches by craving no riches. The vehicle in which I have taken my seat is a farmer's cart. Only by walking do the mules show that they are alive. The driver is barefoot, and not because it is summer either. I can scarcely force myself to wish that others shall think this cart mine. My false embarrassment about the truth still holds out, you see, and whenever we meet a more sumptuous party, I blush in spite of myself. Proof that this conduct which I approve and applaud has not yet gained a firm and steadfast dwelling place within me. He who blushes at riding in a rattle-trap will boast when he rides in style. So my progress is still insufficient. I have not yet the courage openly to acknowledge my thriftiness. Even yet, I am bothered by what other travelers think of me. But, instead of this, I should really have uttered an opinion counter to that in which mankind believe, saying, "You are mad, you are misled, your admiration devotes itself to superfluous things. You estimate no man at his real worth. When property is concerned, you reckon up in this way, with most scrupulous calculation, those to whom you shall lend either money or benefits. For by now you enter benefits also as payments in your ledger. You say, 'His estates are wide, but his debts are large. He has a fine house, but he has built it on borrowed capital.' No man will display a more brilliant retinue on short notice, but he cannot meet his debts. If he pays off his creditors, he will have nothing left. So you will feel bound to do in all other cases as well, to find out by elimination the amount of every man's actual possessions. I suppose you call a man rich, just because his gold plate goes with him even on his travels, because he farms land in all the provinces, because he unrolls a large account book, because he owns estates near the city so great that men would grudge his holding them in the wastelands of Apulia. But after you have mentioned all these facts, he is poor. And why? He is in debt. To what extent, you ask? For all that he has. Or, perchance you think it matters, whether one has borrowed from another man or from fortune. What good is there in mules caparisoned in uniform livery, or in decorated chariots and steels decked with purple and with tapestry, with golden harness hanging from their necks, champing their yellow bits, all clothed in gold? Neither master nor mule is improved by such trappings. Marcus Cato the Censor, whose existence helped the state as much as did Scipio's, for while Scipio fought against our enemies, Cato fought against our bad morals, used to ride a donkey, and a donkey at that, which carried saddlebags containing the master's necessaries. Oh, how I should love to see him meet today on the road one of our coxcombs, with his outriders and Numidians, and a great cloud of dust before him. Your dandy would no doubt seem refined and well attended in comparison with Marcus Cato. Your dandy who, in the midst of all his luxurious paraphernalia, is chiefly concerned whether to turn his hand to the sword or to the hunting knife. Oh, what a glory to the times in which he lived, for a general who had celebrated a triumph, a censor, and, what is most noteworthy of all, a Cato, to be content with a single nag, and with less than a whole nag at that, for part of the animal was preempted by the baggage that hung down on either flank. Would you not therefore prefer Cato's steed, that single steed, saddle worn by Cato himself, to the coxcomb's whole retinue of plump ponies, Spanish cobs, and trotters? I see that there will be no end in dealing with such a theme unless I make an end myself. So I shall now become silent, at least with reference to superfluous things like these. Doubtless, the man who first called them hindrances had a prophetic inkling that they would be the very sort of thing they now are. At present, I should like to deliver to you the syllogisms, as yet very few, belonging to our school and bearing upon the question of virtue, which, in our opinion, is sufficient for the happy life. That which is good